You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to Smart Sex, Smart Love. We're talking about sex goes beyond the taboos, and talking about love goes beyond the honeymoon. I'm Dr. Joe Court. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome to Smart Sex, Smart Love. I'm Dr. Joe Court, and today the topic of our podcast is how porn and sex are different in the brain. On today's show, I'll be discussing that, and there's been a tremendous amount of noise about watching porn, with many doomsayers claiming that it triggers dangerous neurochemical changes in the brain. But newer research says that it isn't so, and that people who state they have a problem watching porn, otherwise known as porn addicts, are actually people with high libidos, not people whose brains have been warped by sex addiction and porn. Anti-porn advocates argue that porn is a public health issue, and that if individuals in society only knew the damage that porn use was causing to our brains, we would regulate it. These fear-based arguments often invoke brain-related lingo and throw around terms like dopamine bursts and desensitization to describe what allegedly happens in the brains of people who watch too much porn. But my guest today, American neuroscientist Nikki Prowse, thinks that this is nonsense, that porn and sex are totally different in the brain. Brain science is hot these days, and rigorous studies have not found sex addiction to be real or reflective of any unique brain-related issues at all. So today I'll be asking Nikki how the research debunks the myth that anybody can have an addiction to sex or to porn. Welcome, Nikki.
Thanks, Joe. Excuse me. Thank you.
Yeah, it's really good to have you here. I refer to your work all the time, and now I'm going to be able to say in my talks, if you want to learn more, not just to Google you, but to come to my podcast and hear direct questions I'm going to ask you.
Sweet, sweet traffic. Sounds good.
So could you tell us why, just the first part is, why don't you think that sex addiction is an addiction, or porn addiction is an addiction?
There are obviously people who have problems in these areas. You know, they look at porn more than they mean to, or they have sex at times when they didn't plan to, that's inconsistent with their values. So of course we want to recognize that it's not, we're saying there's no struggles, but the question is, how do you understand what those struggles are? That is how, what kind of a model best fits those behaviors, because the model that best fits determines how you help. And so if the problem is mainly, for example, having unusually strict values due to your religious upbringing, that would be important information and would change how you might treat or help someone. So addiction is a model that is very strict. It has many very specific predictions about things that have to happen in the brain and in behavior to call something an addiction. And while sex and porn fit some of those, this is a necessary but not sufficient argument. That is, it has to fit all of them, and it fails in numerous ways to fit addiction models.
Okay. And so, and really, even your current research investigates the physiology of orgasm and sexual touch from a partner and focuses on how these may benefit general health like sleep. And then you're also the founder of, is it Liberos? Am I saying that right?
Liberos.
It's an independent research study. And so you're really studying neurological research that actually shows about how people use porn or watch porn, I should say, and how it's debunking these myths, right?
Absolutely. So we have people, for example, coming in, interacting with partners in the lab while we monitor both of their brains to try and understand how those brain responses with a partner are different from viewing pornography or masturbating, if they are.
And so how is it dismantling or debunking? Like, so someone would say, well, then what are you finding that make it not an addiction?
One of the first big findings was a lack of Curie activity. And what that means, so Curie activity has sometimes been called a biomarker of addiction. It's so commonly and regularly found in substance addiction. And it basically means that your brain orients more strongly to the substance or behavior to which you're addicted than other stimuli that we're presenting you with in the laboratory. So if you were addicted, or that you were addicted to pornography, and we showed you pornographic images, we would expect that your brain would respond more strongly to those images than other people who view these images and do not report having a problem. And we actually found the opposite in this case. And that's not habituation evidence. That is, some people have misinterpreted it that way. It just means that the early, and when I say early, we're talking 300 milliseconds.
Okay.
Very, very fast. So this is not talking about later habituation effects. This is the early cue reactivity that needs to be there for an addiction does not exist with respect to pornography.
Okay. That's helpful to know because people don't understand. They think, well, you know, they think people spend all day watching porn. What does that mean? It must mean that they're addicted to something. What would you say to that?
In each case, you have to think functionally, of course, because it could be that someone is depressed and can't get out the door, but they can click a mouse and that gives them some pleasure during the day, in which case I think these people are depressed. And they're using, you know, porn is either a coping or a distraction, you know, could be one function or the other. Some people seem to present more obsessive compulsive, presentation so that, you know, every night I get home and this is my routine. I do 3 hours of porn and it upsets my partner and, causes me to miss events I was supposed to be at, because of this strong habit formation that I've created that maybe helps me deal with the stress of the workday so that I can distract my mind from it. So in both those cases, those people could benefit from help. We have good treatments to help with depression. We have good treatments for OCD, but it's not the porn per se. And it's important to get the focus off of the substance because that doesn't seem to be causal.
Right. So in this situation, and I want people to know who are listening, OCD, you mean obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yes.
Right. So people do have these things. And what's really always been concerning to me is that the sex addiction industry, instead of just calling it OCD or just calling it habituation or calling it erotic tension with one's partner or values or religion, they want to add on. It's an add on to say it's a sex addiction. We don't need that term. We already have the term, right? Erotic tension, yeah. OCD, whatever, depression, whatever it is.
That's exactly. And the question with a new diagnosis is always, you know, do you gain more than you lose? And new addiction, new diagnoses do cause harm. That is, while some people feel comforted by them, say, oh, now I have a label for what I have. A large other group of population is distressed. Say, oh, God, you know, I didn't know I had a disease. I'm sick and could actually make them worse. And what I haven't seen is any demonstration that a porn addiction label doesn't make more people worse than it makes better. And that's a big concern.
It's a big concern. Sadly, in my office, what I end up seeing is now I tend to see more heterosexual couples who struggle with porn. And usually it's the wife that says to her husband, you better be either a sex addict or you're either a sex addict or you're a pervert. And I'm not staying married to a pervert. So you better be a sex addict, right? What choice does he end up having if he wants to stay in a relationship with her?
Well, that's, I know, two large university clinics as well. They're saying all these guys are coming in for porn treatment, and they said they spend half of their treatment getting them out of the addiction mindset because they've gone through these horrible addiction programs that teach them inaccurate information that make them think they're going to molest their brother or their child, and that's simply not true. There's no evidence for it, but you can imagine how distraught someone would be if they think that's the path they're on because of this addictionology. And so they said they're having to spend a lot of treatment time undoing the damage from the porn addiction treatment.
It's so true. I've had clients where they've been told, I've had multiple clients like this, where they've been told by a sex addiction therapist, if you're watching porn and it's young women, that's a gateway to abusing children, abusing young women.
Yep.
And they,
so many people are being told that, and it's just horrific. There's no evidence for that.
It is a scare tactic. It's anecdotal. It's stupid. You know what I mean? And really abusive and harmful to someone because, sadly, sex addiction therapists in general do not receive sex therapy training. So they're only looking through trauma and addiction. They know nothing about sex.
Yes. And that's, you know, it's important to know base rates with a lot of these things. You know, we have had this even in a few academic papers, for example, talking about women in BDSM. I just recently responded to a paper and you're talking about the pathology of that. And I was like, my God, that's the most common female sexual fantasy. but they didn't have exactly the human sexuality background training to know that that was a very common intentional female fantasy. So that kind of basic information, sex education is really important to have. And I don't think you can accurately treat any of these patients without it.
Or just like you said, you can't even do accurate research without it because then it's they misunderstand what's happening.
Absolutely.
Could you speak to, I've been reading a lot of your stuff and other people like David Lay and about the fact that in the porn addiction research, they don't talk about masturbation, right?
Yes, this is so bizarre.
So, yeah, would you talk about that?
The main problem with not talking about masturbation is it means you cannot attribute any effects in your studies to porn unless you have controlled for the fact that people are always masturbating when they're viewing porn. So what that means is, you know, if I want to say, oh, porn caused me not to be able to get erect. And I said, well, you know, how much are you watching? Oh, I watched 5 hours. Okay, well, that sounds like a lot for a day, but what were you doing during that? Oh, I had 5 orgasms. I was like, oh my God, there's nothing to do with the porn. You had 5 orgasms. that's the crux of the issue. So anyone that's had that much sexual experience in a day, I would expect would struggle regardless of the partner context, in a partnered context. So there are those kind of really concrete problems. That is, you know, you can't attribute any of these findings to pornography unless you have controlled for either statistically or experimentally the presence of masturbation.
And that makes sense.
We can't.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just it's an absolute essential. And if I'm getting to the point now as a reviewer, if studies don't control for it, I reject the study because it's that important. It's that strong of a correlate. And if you can't prove that it's having an effect above and beyond that, you can't publish.
That's awesome. I think it's so important because, you know, I don't know where I heard this. I wish I could remember who taught me this, but I really like it. That while people are watching porn, yes, they're masturbating, and porn never says no. It never has a headache. It never tells you, it doesn't judge you. It doesn't say, okay, now we got to stop. I mean, it's really an autoerotic experience, which is why a lot of these guys end up turning to their partners and then they're unable to get erections. But it's not the porn. It's the masturbation and getting used to their own self and their own timing, isn't it?
I think so. And there's also some data around fantasy. So I'm really interested exactly in how porn is used when it's used. That is, when people do have these longer periods, exactly like how many orgasms are they having? And are they imagining themselves in the film? Or are they using the film as a jumping off point for fantasy and memory, like recall of pleasant experiences? Because those also really impact what could be happening potentially in the brain. You know, that is, if you're okay, the porn is up, but because that reminds me of my ex-girlfriend and the thing we did, and that's really what I'm fantasizing about when I'm masturbating. It's a very complex kind of situation, stimulus interaction that, you know, is not just porn. And to treat it monolithically like that and miss all of that information, I just see a lot of research is reinventing the wheel. That's they're discovering things that we knew about masturbation 30, 40 years ago and saying now it's due to porn because they're not properly controlling those things.
That's smart. That makes so much sense. And so right in a therapy situation, or if even a person listening to this might start wondering, what am I looking at? And am I in the porn and am I not in the porn? Because that may be more the issue of their personal life than anything to do with the porn. Mm-hmm. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like how are you using it? You know, if you're masturbating to it, which is what most folks do, some people call it edging. I just say being sexually aroused.
Yeah.
Are you just having an erection or, being aroused during that whole period? If you're having an orgasm, when is that happening? Like, you kind of saving it for the very last, just once, or is it, you know, as many times as you can in that period? Those are kind of different struggles. You know, that is, if you're being aroused for a lot of the time, versus having a lot of climax experiences. So, you know, are you getting a big doses of repetitive prolactin or not?
Yes.
Prolactin surges at orgasm. So that's why it's important. I think now the next step in research should be to start characterizing and understanding the nature of the masturbation that's occurring with porn rather than the porn.
One of my biggest pet peeves are when therapists say, or not even just therapists, it's in our culture that porn is a national health crisis. It's ruining marriages. And then I always say, well, excuse me, but not in gay and lesbian relationships. It's not ruining our relationships. When I met my husband 26 years ago, I knew exactly where his porn was and what he looked at. And I looked nothing like the guys in his porn. When he saw my porn and knew where I kept my stash, this is before the internet, he looks nothing like the guys I get off on. We had a sex life with each other and we had a sex life with ourselves. And we call it now porn literacy, where we had a conversation around it. Isn't that what straight couples aren't having? Porn literate conversations.
Absolutely. And I think that hits on, Marty Klein wrote his book recently, His Porn, Her Pain, getting into a lot of concrete examples about this, but it's the interpretation of what porn comes to mean to a couple. So there are the extreme cases where often a woman in heterosexual relationship will say the porn is infidelity to me. Merely looking at that is cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you feel and have that value, that is a very difficult value in conversation to overcome.
Yes.
And really puts constraints on your partner. So, but that's what it is. It's a values conversation. You know, what are we comfortable with? What does this mean to me? And exactly in your partner's case, like, they don't look like me. Does that mean you don't like me?
Yeah, right. You know,
that's the conversation.
Yes.
It's really like the insecurity, the common relationship concerns people have had for all millennia that are not new to porn.
So let's talk about this, because I get this a lot and I'd love your input on this. Your smart scientific information. Many people start viewing porn. No, sorry, I have you on the spot, but it's so important and I don't think I do a good enough job.
Yeah.
All right. So a lot of people start watching porn by the age of 10 when the brain is still developing. Is it true to say that there's no way to tell whether structural brain differences are a consequence or a cause of porn or watching porn?
Yes. So to be able to tell something like that, you have to do random assignment in a trial. And it's illegal to show youth porn, so we will never be able to do that. And the problem, just to draw it out with that and why we can't make those conclusions, is the kids self-select. So, they don't, just because their average age of first intercourse is 17 and a half, they didn't just start having sex then. the average means a lot, did it before then. And kids are developing sexual interests and sexual motivations, and they're expressing that in part through looking at pornography. But of course, the kids who have higher sex drive are going to look more at pornography probably earlier. So you cannot then separate and say, well, the kids who looked at it earlier, are having this and that effect, because they're not the same kids who weren't looking at it. They differ systematically in other ways.
Mm.
So you really have to do an experiment to demonstrate that porn was the cause of any of those differences. And we can't. It's illegal.
And the other thing that's missing, and I always say this, is that parents aren't talking to their kids about porn. They're trying to prohibit it, which is fine. They're trying to restrict it, and that's fine, whatever your family values are. But your kid is still going to look at porn whether you like it or not. And without having a sexual health conversation of what it means to be watching porn and what's happening to them. And, I just found out in the Netherlands, they show porn, little clip scenes, to kids in middle school and in high school, and they stop and they say, what's happening here? What's missing here? And they educate the kids around it rather than leaving them at sea, right?
Yeah, that's incredibly strong sex ed. I'm surprised we could do that here. But I always remind people that when you look at the sexual values, I think parents are often fearful that they're talking to their friends and being influenced by looking at porn with their friends nowadays, but the sexual values of the kids most strongly align with their parents, not their peers.
That's great.
They're still influenced, but it really is important that if they don't know what your sexual values are, they can't do anything about it.
Right.
So you have to tell them
yes,
so that they know that. Then can be influenced by it.
So what about this? I always say, I started watching porn when I was 11. My father started watching porn when he was 11. His father did. In the Stone Age, they carved it into the rock and watched, masturbated to porn. But now people say, well, that was different porn. Now we have this, what is it, high speed, since 2000, right? It's different porn, which changes the brain more. What do you say to that?
There's currently no evidence that the nature of the porn that we currently have is doing anything different in the brain than when we were testing people using VHS tapes. It was my first ever study in grad school. And so certainly the nature of it is different. It's more accessible. There's wider breadth. And so maybe we would find sometime in the future that we can document some kind of a difference, but sexual arousal is sexual arousal in the brain. And there's no reason to think, maybe we get more activation of visual cortices, for example, by more complex visual stimuli. So if we get into VR porn, which I think is going to have a pretty limited audience, you're doing VR, you might have a lot more engagement in visual areas because there is more visual stimulation. There's simply more going on. The question is, does that translate to anything that's qualitatively different or problematic? And we haven't seen any evidence for that. So even going all the way out to kind of future tech, I don't see that the brain is somehow being hijacked or anything is unique and different about the sexual arousal to one type of, you know, more high resolution porn versus the type of VHS porn we used to show. The brain patterns appear to be the same. No one's ever documented any differences. So, you know, that's not to say there's not other issues with having the breadth of selection and those types of things with internet access. But the brain, there's just no evidence that it's doing anything remarkably different.
Okay, so what about people listening to this going, no, I've been to this website and that website. It's all over the internet, and there are peer-reviewed journal articles themselves that say you're absolutely wrong, that there is a brain hijack, and this is all about changing, you know, all that research that's out there, right? What do you say?
Yeah, all those personal essays that people write who don't do neuroscience research, I'm aware. So there are a number of myths that people are capitalizing on to try and make that case. So, for example, we often see people say, oh, it's, you know, the dopamine hijacks the brain. It comes in, you get flooded with dopamine. And of course, words like flooded, that's a good way to know you're reading pseudoscience. We don't use those words. Hijacked is another good way. You know, we don't generally use those words in science. And with dopamine, there are, of course, changes in dopamine, which help us learn and remember things, as a course of being sexually aroused and seeing sexual stimuli. But that's true of emotional stimuli broadly. So also when we see something disgusting or frightening, we also have an increase in dopamine. And the studies, these are very, very limited studies, to be fair, but the studies who have looked at orgasm do not find that dopamine spikes at orgasm. That is, it happens before, during the sexual arousal period. So there doesn't seem to be any flood. You know, when is the flood coming? There's a flood. And so I always kind of laugh when I see that language, because I'm like, I'm not sure who wrote this. But that's a common kind of scare word that we see used with neurochemical changes.
Well, speaking of dopamine, some people think you can get addicted to your own internal chemicals, and dopamine's addictive. And I keep reading that's not true, right?
Yeah, that's not. I mean, so in any kind of a substance addiction, dopamine is involved. I wouldn't ever say, oh, dopamine has no role, but it's part of a much larger presentation, and all of those pieces of the constellation have to be present for something to be an addiction. Dopamine's involved in a lot of things. So just having had a dopamine change tells me very little about whether or not something's addictive.
I love it. So now what we're really talking about is helping people self-regulate. And what they're doing is regulating through porn, regulating through sex, regulating through food, regulating through gaming, whatever the hell they're gambling. But it's not necessarily – even in gambling. We don't even call gambling an addiction. People always say to me, well, isn't gambling an addiction? No, we call it a disorder. And it's problematic, and it's a dysregulation around money and around, you know, dopamine rushes or whatever. But it's not – it's not an addiction. Would you agree?
And we still have good treatments to help you reduce your use.
Yes.
You know, that's, I think the big crux is people like, oh, that's terrible. You know, they're denying that it's that it's a problem. And then saying something's not an addiction versus saying something's not a problem are two completely separate issues. And that often gets lost, I think.
So yes.
They are making the case like this is not an addiction isn't saying, you know, screw you, get out of my office, we're not going to help you. It's saying, we have a more accurate, empirically supported method for helping you. And addiction is not it.
What have we not addressed that you think is a really important point you'd like people to hear?
I think it's good to know that there are lots of differences in the brain when you're viewing porn versus interacting with a partner. And this is part of why I always say I don't fear the sex robots, because they, wherever our technology goes, there are certain things that are special to being with a partner that it can't really mimic. So, for example, one of the easiest ones of those is something called C-afferent fibers. That is, when your skin, not genitals, but just skin is stroked by another person in a slow way that really uniquely activates these fibers that then feed back into social emotional areas of the brain. And this does not occur when you view pornography. That is, just watching someone do the stroking does not do it. You have to be there with another human being who is not wearing gloves, who is like, it really is specific to touch. So there's always going to be that major unique feature between the two. So, you know, there's nothing in porn to condition that or to make it so a partner would be less effective.
Okay.
There are other aspects, like some people say, oh, well, you know, porn activates the motor neurons, and so therefore it's becoming a partner. It's a real partner in your brain. No. So mirror neurons are, in this case, been shown to be motoric. So that is, yes, if you see a penis being touched, you know, your cortical, that's the kind of the outside back of the brain, does show activation to show, yes, I am observing a penis being touched, and my brain also thinks, that my penis might be involved. So there's activation associated. But that doesn't mean any of the other affective or motivational systems are engaged, and there's no evidence for that. So, you know, merely having mirror neurons activated does not mean that your brain is doing the same thing that it does with a partner. And, you know, we don't think it does. So, you know, do not fear the mirror neurons in the motor cortex. You know, I don't think those are maybe another kind of thing to worry about. And then the last bit I might say is there's, we're just kind of on cutting edge of studying something we're preliminarily calling the periorgasmic period that seems to be really unique before you get to climax. That is the brain seems to reduce cognitive control, and since the nervous system drops off, we didn't know this happened 2 years ago, so this is potentially pretty new physiology stuff. But if that's true, if there is this periorgasmic period, then I would say you would never get there with porn. You know, if you're just sitting watching it and not masturbating, you're going to stay in the earlier arousal phases. It's only when you add the masturbation or add a partner, you know, that you can get into this, we think, periorgasmic period. So that may be just another one to keep an eye out for, but just another way in which viewing films and being intimate with another person are probably very distinct.
Wow, this is so good, and I really appreciate this. Can you tell us, before we stop, where people can find your work and find you?
Easiest is my website, librocenter.com, LIBEROS.com, and you can spider out from there to Twitters and LinkedIn's and Facebook.
Nikki, I really appreciate this. You're so smart. You're very logical about this stuff, and I hope people got that out of listening to you here. And I don't know. I just have to say I have to go because I have to go watch porn and masturbate to my own. So we got to go. No, but I appreciate
nice
you normalizing. Yeah, it's nice talking to you. And I do appreciate you normalizing this.
Thanks so much.
See you. All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Smart Sex, Smart Love. I'm Dr. Joe Court, and you can find me on joecourt.com. That's joecourt.com. See you next time.